cat in the background?
Yeah.
There's certainly a cat.
Is she a bit much? The big story over here, for all the fans of the show who have been taking in all the other storylines and so on, is that I'm now a cat grandpa.
Wow.
Yeah. Big news. So if you hear squeaking throughout this, and they're being very vocal at the moment, oh, she's licking her babies.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So the neighborhood cat that I talked about on the last episode that was bringing all the boys to our yard gave birth in our closet just behind here.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it was one of the most amazing things. So Adelia and I were watching this cat get progressively more pregnant, right, over the course of weeks. And we're like, it's got to go any day now. Like any day now, she's like a balloon. Like we can see all these like lumps in the side of her belly. It just didn't look normal. For 3 weeks, she looked like she was on the cusp of pregnancy. And one day she came up to us in a fit of howling and convulsions, actually. And we were in the kitchen. This is kind of nuts. Have you ever seen a cat give birth?
Yes. I lived on a farm as a kid, right?
Right.
Lots of barn cats.
Right. But I'd never seen it, right? I've had cats in my life before, but they'd kind of arrived as kittens already. And this head came out of the back end of the cat, the pregnant cat, and then it went in again.
He saw a shadow.
So it peered out, this little black head just peered out, half a head, and then it went back in again. And the cat was like, I'm not happy. I need to be comfortable. I need to go to a safe place, dark, no noises and so on. So I just opened up the doors to the office, which is where I am today. And the cat runs in, goes straight into the second level of the wardrobe, which was open, and just makes a little nest on the second level of the wardrobe. And then 5 minutes later, this little cat kind of squishes out again. And the cat's running around and the baby is like half hanging out of the back end of the cat. And then it comes out and calms down. She starts licking it. So we basically watch her give birth to four cats over a period of about 2 hours.
Yeah.
Going in and out.
Just four, that's all?
Yeah, just four. Hmm. That's going to be enough. And today they came out of the wardrobe for the first time. They're sleeping on the floor. And I think they're going to be walking in a day or two.
That's great. I love cats, man.
Yeah.
I completely resonate with cats. I don't sleep at night. I run around the neighborhood yelling, crawl back home. I'm like a cat. I'm a night cat.
Yeah, so it's funny to watch myself as a cat grandpa, right? Like going down the supermarket, like at 10 o'clock at night when I really don't want to, being like, well, I need to get some cat litter because it's not going to be able to go in the middle of the night and it needs to teach the babies where to go and all that kind of stuff. We don't want
it's a commitment, Jordan, and you have to think ahead now.
Well, these are the experiences I would never have had if it wasn't for COVID.
Oh, that's true.
I'd never had to have settled down and take responsibility over things like cats.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
So that's where we are. That's where I am in the office today.
What's on your background there?
These are my kind of harebrained schemes for art creation, world domination, themes of future projects. So I've got our Essentials course, which is over there, actually. Uh-huh. I've got the Legacy course, which is forthcoming and directly behind me. Mm-hmm. We've got Mastery on this wall, which you cannot see because it's going to ruin the entire podcast setup. And over here, we've got a little bit of yoga that I was studying that I'm twisting and implementing in new ways for our programs. So it's full.
That's great. You know, we're always torn between should we conquer the world or how does it? Conquer the world or save it? Can't decide. Should we be villains? Maybe we are.
Villains or saviors. Yeah. they all weave together into a surprising climax.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. At least there's a consistency.
What's going on your end of things?
Well, we just had our Amirati conference here, as you know, a virtual conference, but we had about 10 guys in town who managed to brave the borders and flight restrictions and quarantine and lockdowns, et cetera.
Yeah.
And we had a really nice experience, and there's still several guys dangling around in the city, and we'll probably see them this weekend and going for lunch with them, et cetera. It's been nice to have that outlet and to sit with our brethren again, you know.
We're esteemed veterans.
our esteemed veterans, yeah. You know, and our mentors and various things like that. So we've had some great conversations, some great parties. Social distancing, of course, sort of. <You do. laughs> Life's got to go on, man.
Yeah.
So that's what we've been doing. And it's getting a little bit more energetic here in Romania because there's the second wave or the cases are going up. So people are, they locked the restaurants down again yesterday.
Oh.
We used to, they opened it up a few weeks ago that you could go inside restaurants. And now they said, no, that's a little too premature. So we're just still kind of like, you know, I've been reading a lot. I've been listening to audiobooks now for the first time in my life.
You are now an audiobook. You popped your audiobook cherry in both directions.
Yeah, because I finally, for some of you who might not know this, I finally recorded the audio version of The Alabaster Girl, my book. And it was difficult. 10 days with my head stuck in a closet this wide with, you know, clothes hanging around me and the microphone in there so we could dampen it because this the studio apartment I have is too echoey. And I'm sitting leaning in the in there like this into the microphone, staring at the little iPhone in front of my face and scrolling and reading it incredibly hard. And but we did it. And I don't know how it's going to turn out because I don't know how to, if I'm a dynamic reader or, well, it might sound like I'm just reading it, which I kind of am. I don't know, but I'm nervous about it. So, but it's being post-processed now.
Be curious to hear it. It's beautiful, the conditions under which the podcast was made. Like, I want to talk a lot about art today, make a podcast, surprise, surprise, about art and beauty and so on. The story of the great works, the conditions under which they were made, I don't think were ever perfect. You know, like I built the desk and I got the easel and I got the perfect kind of top of the range brushes and paint and I was just ready to go. And then the sublime inspiration came through me. I think it's much more back of a napkin, riding across somewhere in the back of some banged up car or with a head in the wardrobe somewhere with an ambulance going by or...
It's all uncertainty and doubt.
Up in the middle of the night, you go and look at your work and the cat's eating the notepad type thing.
Or you hate it. You look at the work and you think this is like Stephen King, when he wrote, I think it was Carrie was his first novel. He threw the manuscript into the fireplace and his wife rescued it before he was a writer, rescued it. She hated it so much. And she rescued it and, you know, and saved it basically.
Was it a success?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was like a bestseller and it launched him into what he is.
And he threw it away. It was scary, madness. Yeah.
And you know, and uncertainty and doubt. Da Vinci's apparently Leonardo da Vinci's last words were something to the effect of, in all my work, in everything I tried to do and create, I failed before man and God. Yeah. Just, you know, it's all uncertainty and doubt. I was reading about that. Tolkien, who wrote the Ring trilogy, the Lord of the Rings, he wrote a journal at the same time he's writing that, and letters, and his whole journal is filled with what the heck am I going to do now? And he'd be stuck for 6 months on his book because he couldn't solve a problem that he, you know, and he didn't know what to do, and he was like frustrated, wanted to scrap it, and changed everything, and just throughout to the end, he was full of doubt. And if you looked at it today, you would think, wow, this guy created this entire world with a language and it's so coherent and it goes from here to here and it makes all kinds of sense. And he had it all. He picked at it and was disgusted with it. Incredible. That's the history of art.
to give you an update, like a little bit of a disclaimer, I think it's a consequence of these conversations we've been having and just the bigger questions of the Ars Amorata. Like, what does it mean to create a transformational program, a art and kind of literary house?
Yeah, a body tradition. Of work. A body of work.
Yeah, a communal body of work or a congregation or a kind of movement, like all these various things. A part of what we're doing. And of course, I'm more and more interested in restoring beauty, more and more wanting to go in my artistic direction. as a something fresh that draws me in a way that, like, and finding stability and success with coaching as well. I'm feeling, wow, like, I've really got that particular chapter of my life, which was a real long slog. Myself and have experience and learn how, like, the business of coaching and all that kind of stuff works, to feel myself with, I would say, fingertips on the table of arrival in that sphere, it kind of frees me up to think about, like, what really brings me passion to my days and really lights me up. And for sure, a lot of the conversations I have do that, but there's a hunger for art and the artistic process that is it's not even a whisper, it's kind of screaming at me, like, take days off, entire days off, so you can plunge into this world. Mm-hmm. And it's pulling me forth a lot, and it's something I've been thinking about and feeling and practicing more and more. The relationship with the daemon.
Mm-hmm.
So this innate kind of life force, natural intelligence, the innate creativity of a human, this kind of soul force of a person that wants to burst through and express something, or has some kind of knowledge or impression or imprint that he knows from the dream world, let's say, metaphorically, and he wants to bring that back and put it into the waking world as an artifact for other people to see. I love that process. And I know from when I watch art and I see, because it's not all the time, but when I see a musician or I see a dancer or I see somebody who's clearly gone into some other realm entirely and has succeeded in coming back and translating what they've felt, and it hits you like a transmission, to watch that is, there's nothing more sublime than passing my days in that kind of awe and reverence of watching beauty be channeled and transmitted by someone who's devoted themselves to the mastery of it. And in the few flickering moments in my life where I felt myself in that kind of space, I'll check this out with you, actually. I was telling Adelia today, I was talking about writing. And my sense is of the creative process. And I think we finished the last podcast, you were talking about this kind of, there is the newer sphere beyond me and ideas might seep through somehow. And if I miss it, then I don't worry too much because someone else might get it. And
the collective unconscious
in the world, right?
Collective unconscious, as Jung called it. Yeah,
there's something about writing or creating at my best where I feel like 95% of me has slipped out of the waking world and gone into some shamanic realm, and is actually feeling and thinking and picking up on all kinds of play and images and memories and strange connections in there. So 95% of my being is in that. And then there's just 5% like typing away on the keyboard, hoping that my hands can keep up with the discoveries that I'm making in that other realm, right? So it's like, wow. I might hear my head, is this making sense? Blah, blah, blah. Is this coherent?
Well, that's pretty brilliant, Jordan, because
I'm going back.
Because all artists, writers, et cetera, are trying to tap into that. And they sit in their mundane world and they sit with their cup of coffee and they're staring out the window. And the muse doesn't alight on their shoulder, or they don't get that sense of inspiration, and they sit there and pick at it, you know? So if you're having that, that's pretty profound, because most writers, et cetera, are just staring out the window.
Well, it's not a day by day thing, you know, I'm not claiming to be in this kind of virtuoso level of kind of creative shamanism, but, you know, I'm opening up Facebook and just seeing what someone wrote and surfing and see if anything good happened on YouTube overnight and like the rest of us. But I want to talk about this connection with the daemon, and which is exactly what I just expressed. And another thought hit me, which is, I think that many of the men in particular that are drawn to our message, there's two or three things that they don't have, or they don't have access to yet. And it's the same in being a lover as it is in being the artist. Like, these two realms for me are so close and similar in the bulk of them. And I think it, like, one of the big ones is to stop sourcing your energy on something external to you, i.e. the guys who say, I always feel really good and inspired after an Amarati conference, but then after a week or two, my energy goes down to the floor, right? And where can I
get all the ton of comments like that?
So the need to find our life force somehow, and then to look outside to try and get it from women, to get it from community, to get it from peak experiences and so on, versus to source yourself in your own demonic energy, your own creative kind of madman brilliance.
Yeah.
And I want to hear, I'll stop jabbering on, but I want to hear your perspectives of like, how do you get to the essence or the source in you, or what is it like when you're creating at your best, and any like, words about cultivating that relationship to the...
Yeah, first of all, it's to come to alignment with you on your definition of daemon. I think, you know, the ancient Greeks had the concept of the daemon, which was a benevolent spirit that would visit you. Is that right?
Yes, that's what I'm going on. So rather than the demon, which is I'm plagued by my demons, you know, the...
I'm plagued by my demon.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Do you want me to do something? Something great and benevolent. Okay, that's exactly what I was wondering.
And he's bursting through, yeah. I'm certainly not advocating a life of being plagued by demons or even beckoning demons into existence for a curious form of art.
There's a very big distinction there. I think that any the only noble pursuit of anybody is to try and tap into that voice calling in the wilderness, what I would call it, you know, the biblical term. It's like the prophet, you know, is speaking and the people don't listen. So the modern postmodern civilization that we inhabit turns their back on that and says there is nothing to tap into. Like we talked about the last thing, you know, like ever since the Enlightenment, I suppose, we've had this idea of humanism is the center. And there is nothing beyond our chemical experience that we could just, you know, evolution's tapped into that and, you know, all these different things. And there is no meaning and there is no transcendence and there is no mysticism that cannot be explained eventually by a scientific thing. So what you detect and what we're detecting in this modern world, especially in this modern world of disconnection solitude, that people are starving and hungry for a tapping into what you're calling the daemon, you know, that creative force, that creative energy that gives us force. And it's incredible, you know, in our last episodes of this podcast, we've talked about this in a great length, motivation, you know, where the history of art and literature, the turning our face away from beauty. So I'm speaking very generally to answer your question because I don't have a specific answer to your question, but I think this entire conversation could be an answer. No, can be an exploration of that question.
Yeah.
Right? I think so. So, I mean, like, you know, since the Renaissance and in the Enlightenment, which is like, they turned away from mysticism as imagine the societies before the Enlightenment, all societies in all of history, in every spectrum of this, of across the world were, it's like there's rivers and oceans, and society before the Enlightenment was like a river. So if you're born in England, you're born in China, you're born, whatever, you get into the river with everybody else and you have no choice to believe anything else than the official religion of that tribe or that area, right? And you wouldn't consider it. You would not even think, you know? And since then, the modern societies are more like oceans where you can drift with whatever prevailing tide, with whatever wind, or you can sit there and do nothing and choose no direction, or you can shift directions through your life, become one, you know, religious person, or a religious idea, and then follow another new age concept and go to Catholicism, and it's the drifting. And before the Enlightenment, before the Renaissance, to even mention that to somebody in any civilization, they think you're nuts. How could you possibly do that? No, society sets your beliefs and you follow the stream, you follow the river. It's something that's really, really strongly shifted. We had, you know, I think it was the German philosopher, Jasper, I think, talked about the axial age, And axial means the pivotal age. And that was from about 300 or you know, 800 BC to 300 BC. And the axial age was in India, in Persia, in China, in Greco-Roman civilizations. The flowering of ideas that weren't existing before blossomed, you know, in science and medicine and in religion. All the great religions started, you know.
Yeah.
And without any contact with each other, parallel, they came up with similar ideas of civilization, ethics, etc., that didn't exist before, and it blossomed. So, I don't know what I'm trying to say. Interesting.
Yeah. I was wondering, like, so what's your part to play in that? Like, you're laying out this massive historical context of, like,
well, I'll tell you, this is the
innovation standard.
This is the Arjuna Murata philosophical attempt of contribution, attempt to contribute. Since the 50s, for sure, since the 1900, perhaps, all culture that used to be handed down from in tradition, right? Traditional culture, high culture, what we could call high culture, highbrow or lowbrow, right? Like the common people would play their fiddles and do the jig and plunk, plunk, plunk on the piano. And the highbrow would be all sophisticated Mozart, and, you know, Beethoven, et cetera. And what has happened in this last 100 and whatever years is the commercialization of all this into a pop culture. And it's, and that pop culture, that commercialized pop culture, the Disneyfication of culture completely eroded everything highbrow and lowbrow and melted all into the one giant global cosmopolitan culture of commercialization. And it's all, you know, pre-recorded, pre-invented, pre-designed, focus group tested, the whole thing. And the problem is with this Disneyfication of culture is it subsumed and gobbled up anything else remaining, you know, anything else. So it's all about, the culture today is all about commercialization, and it doesn't sell like an ad or an advertising jingle does not sell the product. It sells happiness. It sells belonging. It sells wholeness. You don't want to buy the beer. You want to be like those guys in the beer commercial, right? You want those. Right. That's what it's selling. So yeah. What we've lost in this really, and it's a real religion of rush, and the whole idea of this rushing culture, especially in the last 20 years, where social media has taken the world by storm, taken our culture by storm in ways we haven't imagined, and the ways that the human race was not ready for. Realistically, it's like it's overwhelmed us. It's destroyed the concept of media, destroyed the concept of, you know, all these things. And so we're trying to catch up, and it's running too fast for our collective souls to understand. So there's a real, you know, the postmodern age can be said to be a scattered age, because it's we had Newton, who said, you know, who came from mysticism and religion and said, wait a minute, we're starting with the Enlightenment age, where science is supreme, humanistic view is supreme, all these things, right? And then what happened is the turn of the century with quantum physics and all this uncertainty principles, and realizing in the last 100 years that the universe is so huge. We had no idea before, you know? And so it puts a bunch of uncertainty into literature, into cultures, and so now everybody can be in this ocean and pick any drift you want. And there's, in fact, you're looked at as strange if you follow a religion as opposed to the other way around. And that was never in the history of the world. You always followed a religion of some kind, you know? So the idea is that because of this, everything I'm foaming at the mouth for all this entire subject, but the idea that there's a turning back or a desire to turn back to beauty, to a beautiful experience, to a calming experience, to go back into the rediscover the transcendent and the sublime, you know. And that's what's starving. That's why you've got those things on the wall, because men and women are completely devoid. There's no place to turn. You can't look at art anymore. You can't look at architecture. You can't look at science. You can't look at, it's all been, you know, any kind of sense of aesthetic or element or beauty has been slapped away as like non-interesting or trite. And it's wrong. So,
yeah.
So that's our collective mission. Restoring beauty.
So in this scattered, centerless universe that we're all trying to navigate our way through, one of the important things I wanted to add to your list of things under the Disneyfication is that once entertainment becomes pre-recorded, then most people just become passive consumers of it. So I think just the sheer number of musicians, artists, writers, participatory creators of the arts is probably kind of percentage-wise in our culture has been lower than it's ever been.
Okay.
And there's my sense, I mean...
Yeah, because it's mass-produced now.
People celebrate the fact that you can kind of post instantly to Instagram and Facebook and all that kind of stuff.
And everybody's an author and everybody's a...
Yeah. But it's such a fast pace and driven by other motives, activity, that I think there's relatively little artistic purity. Well, at least coming on my Facebook feed. It's quite right. Heavily antagonistic and politicized. So I think... My question, actually, I want to say one of the most beautiful things I remember being with you guys in Las Vegas, of all places, years ago. And it felt to me like the most bohemian experience that I'd ever had in that.
I remember that.
Coming home from whatever daily thing that we were doing, there would be at least three people in the house at once, like all vying to have the guitar or to share a song that they've been practicing or writing for the day. And other people would be outside on the porch storytelling and so on. And it's like, well, there's like actual people who are creating things. Like we might have been 50 or 100 years ago. Well, there is no entertainment. There is no pre-recorded entertainment. So we have to create our own. And actually, like so many of the people drawn to our message are longing for that kind of experience. I want to go traveling to some place in time where I can be in a room of people who are actually participating and creating and sharing authentically. Because to sing in front of a group of people in a house party is... You got to be authentic. Right? Like the to share yourself in that way is very, very foreign. No wonder we struggle with like flirting, intimate playfulness when so many of us are never trained in sharing our souls or sharing ourselves artfully in any kind
social
of way.
Graces. We don't. Right. We don't. We have no social communion. The word is communion. You know, to sit in that house in Vegas or wherever we've been, it's a great sense of communion with others. You're sitting, you know.
Yes, and what the thing that makes this communion important is that there's not a widescreen TV with some Netflix series that can save our asses, meaning that I can avoid actually sharing myself within this gathering because we're going to triangulate all our attention on this prepackaged entertainment. But actually, there's no entertainment in the room. Like, your ass is not saved. You have to kind of show up and speak your voice, speak your demonic energy to the group and have that be received or derided or included and twisted or whatever people do with it. But...
Go ahead.
Yeah, my question... under all this was like in this distracted, entertainment saturated, not trained as creators of the arts or of self-expression in general, like within this whole panorama that you laid out at this point in history, how do you do your tiny little thing as a one person kind of ant speck out there in the ocean? Where and how do you turn towards something in order to
create what is meaningful, beautiful to you?
Wow, that's a great question. Like on a personal level, how do you manifest that in your life, in your corner of the world, in your community, et cetera? Yeah. Because that's a big question that I'm certain everybody that's interested in this podcast is sitting in. How do I personally do that? You know,
how do I personally restore beauty given my extreme limitations? And we're all extreme.
I think it's like tapping into it's tapping into the idea that we've lost of wonder. To be sitting in massive wonder about this time in history, about our perspective in it, you know, we can be cruising through the sky at hundreds of miles an hour, quietly sipping a coffee and reading a book. If that doesn't fill someone with wonder, what will? You know, that blows my mind. or you can right? You're quietly drinking a coffee. How is this possible? And then the history of man from the, you know, caveman to now, they're like, no, that's not possible. And we have in something the size of this, the size of this, we have 10,000 songs. You have Beethoven, it's right there at your fingertips, and we have blasé and we're bored.
Yeah,
if that doesn't fill you with wonder, what will? So it's
every novel that was ever censored is now available for free.
Right.
On the tip of your Kindle, you know, people would be waiting 20 years to get their hands on a copy of Tropic of Cancer, for example.
And yet, we're in depression, malaise, jaded. We're jaded. We bitch about society. We bitch about everything, and everything's amazing. Like that, who's that? The comedian said that everything's amazing, and nobody's happy. Incredible. So it's like, so when you tap into, back up and look at the perspective of your little one dot on this timeline of the universe, you're a tiny, not even a dot. You're a minus dot. You know, your lifespan, your perspective, etc. And you get to live in this great, amazing age where it's an age of wonder, but we don't have wonder. We have cynicism and we have aggression and we're angry at our neighbors and we're angry at everything and we're angry at their phone won't reboot in 30 seconds instead of, you know, 2 minutes. Like we get angry about that. It's insane. So if you can tap back into the wonder of the creation that you were of this experience that you're in right now, then you can talk about it with aplomb and with sincerity and with gravitas. You know, you can speak about it that people will listen. It's this postmodern age, which we're still inhabiting, and nobody can define postmodernism, of course, or when it started or if it ended. We have no idea. But anyway, it
slips through your fingers and gets deconstructed as soon as you have a half decent stab, right?
Exactly. And it's like, but it's based on uncertainty and disagreements in science and discord that arose from the world wars we had, World War I, World War II. Wait a minute. We thought society was progressing and brotherly love and humanity was coming together. And then that happened. And then science was all orderly and Copernicus and Newton said, you know, it's a perfect, ellipse and the universe has this mathematical coherence. And then uncertainty came into it, quantum uncertainty. Like none of it makes sense on that level. And no one can reconcile that. No one can figure it out. So we sit in this, this is what we're inhabiting and we've lost. Well, I won't repeat myself. So there's basically, in my mind, there's three phases of modern society. I guess you could say there's superstition and faith, or mysticism and faith. That's better. Superstition. No, mysticism and faith, every culture in every part of the world, up until the Renaissance basically was based on mysticism and faith, and then rationality, and we can think our way through this, and we don't need we no longer need the help of mysticism. We can, it's humanism, rationality and humanism. And now we're in this age, this post modernity age of uncertainty and doubt.
Post-truth age.
Every wind.
Anything that you think is certain, like, we'll deconstruct it. So we want to take away everyone's legs that they're standing on.
Exactly.
Right, level the playing field. We're in this question because I inquired about what do we each do as individual specks out in the ocean,
right,
in order to turn towards the transcendent. I think we could come back to that, like, unless you've...
Well, let me comment a bit more about that, because it doesn't mean that we all have to strive to create. Well, no, we do. It's a striving for art. You know, there's a distinction of art, that art has no purpose. It has no functionality. So, for instance, a cabinet, a wooden cabinet, can be aesthetically pleasing and be absolutely beautiful. But because it's functional, we don't call it high art, because it has a utility. So I think that what that individual can do is to strive for art. Maybe he's not a painter or a writer or, you know, a musician, but to create your life. And we talk about designing your life as a work of art, so that you can look back on it when you're 9 years old, go, man, I tried that and I did that and I did this. And, you know, we talk about people that are stuck in dead end jobs, dead end cities, dead end relationships, and the glory of casting that aside and renunciation and marching into an unknown to take ourselves at the throat and go, I'm scared, but I'm gulping, but I'm going to do it anyway. And that's creating a life of art. So you can look back at the artistic experience you created. And so, yeah, the individual, the answer to that, to do your small part to add to culture. Because when we do something like, if you and I go to London or Vancouver or something, and we create a weekend intensive, for instance, like we used to do, right? We do weekend intensive. Are we not adding to the culture of London? Yeah, in our infinitesimal way, we are adding to the culture that city has experienced. It's adding something to it, even if it's like, right? So in your little way.
Just thinking about that, depending on the kind of orientation of the person out on a night out in London, they can either be stealing from the culture, like, how can I break in here and not pay and just take as much experience as I can and then maybe repurpose it and take it somewhere else. I'm going to copy this particular aesthetic or this club and do it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Or you can be consuming the culture. I'm not adding anything to it, but I'm stood by the bar with my pint and I paid my entrance fee so that the people can go on doing their thing. But there's little self-expression being actually included in the space.
Yeah. You're not adding.
I think to actually be able to say that you're creating or contributing to the culture, you really have to be doing something generous and of self-expression. Like, a case in point would be the Facebook groups that we have and the different things that get shared there. So
okay, yeah.
You might get certain people that comment all the time, hey, where's the recording for this thing? Hey, I didn't get my email. Hey, you said this was going to be posted yesterday and it's not, right? So that's one type of comment that we get often. And then you get another type of comment, which is, guys, I had this experience the other day with a woman or a walk in the park or a trip that I made, or I went to the museum and this is what I saw and this is how it moved me. And this is the question I'm left with. And
yeah.
So that there's a real participatory quality, even in a Facebook group. And it's like that's how you can be adding to the stockpile of culture, or just walking through and doing a fart, you know, in the middle of it without any connection.
You added something.
yeah.
You know, it's interesting, Jordan, before you go there, it's like what you're describing is this. And it just occurred to me this, I never thought this before, but this sense of entitlement of this modern age was never in the history of any culture except for the monarchy and the aristocracy. They felt entitled, but that's trickled down to the common person, where where's my, you promised this, and where how come I don't have this? it's trickled down to the common, for lack of a better phrasing, man, the common age, as this sense of entitlement on the fundamental level that is part of our being. We never had that in history, except for if you're, you know, of the top of the hierarchy and you're the kings, and then you had super entitlement, but that's trickled down to everyone now. And so I don't know what that means, but it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think we've been forced in that. We've been trained in that. Like, what? My Uber's going to take more than 10 minutes. What the hell? Like, who do these people think they are? Stupid. My food delivery was 20 minutes yesterday, and they've been 45 minutes. They haven't even left me a notification. The fire, like, ignited in the body. I wanted to add some things on this. Traditionalism or pre-modernism, modernism, postmodernism. Like, I got a degree in philosophy, and I still couldn't untangle those words and terms in any real sense. Right? It's taken me 10 or 15 years to actually wrap my head around what those mean. But what I've been looking into is understanding these movements and understanding what they do in the mentality and the psyche of people. And from there, the art comes, and from the art, then these memes propagate even more and even more. So I can give an example, like modernism, from how I understand it, there was a lot of utopianism involved in that, which is,
yes, that's correct.
Now that I've harnessed science, I can create this grand scheme for how humanity should live, and we're all going to be in harmony. So the utopianism was like, I'm going to lead humanity to a greater place. That's a beautiful, there's such a beautiful goodness in that. Like, personally, I think the modern period is some of my favorite literature, and I love that. But of course, it all ended up in disaster, because the grand schemes for humanity people had were communism and fascism and kind of capitalist paradigm that a lot of us are living in now.
It destroyed that utopian ideal. It's destroyed.
Yeah, like they tried to make a utopia, but every utopia fails. In fact, the problem, a lot of people have said, is that the problem with utopianism is just your attempt to claim that you can actually create heaven on earth for everyone in all moments, in all ways. And there has to be a reconciliation with the, this is not going to be ever fully anyone's individual version of utopia, but there can be great flourishings of humanity and good things. But then the postmodern age comes along, and after the world wars and the genocides and so on, it says basically any attempt to try and put your heart on your sleeve and call forth a great vision for humanity is ultimately going to end up in disaster. Why even try?
Yeah, futility. So
the cynicism comes in at this point. Mm-hmm. And I've been looking at, because I think cynicism is probably one of the greatest ingredients to wrap our heads and our hearts around and truly understand how it lives in us and lives in others, because it's the one ingredient that's going to enable you to fall in love or not and have a deeply nourishing relationship. Like, if you're cynical about love, like a lot of people are, oh yeah, it's all right to be this playboy guy, but fall in love, whatever. Men and women with their own cynicism, it's the ultimate kind of poison or barrier around feeling like really letting yourself go and communing with another person. And also in the arts. And I think the one conclusion that, because cynicism comes out in snark culture. It's very safe to be skeptical. It's very safe to be cynical. It's very safe to be snarky, because all I can do is throw daggers at other people, and I never have to expose any utopianistic hope for a better world or a personal longing. You can be absolutely buttressed from the world of violence, bullying, abuse, derision. Like, if you're cynical, you're safe. And comedy has become cynical, and sitcoms have become cynical, and men and women have learned these ways of talking to each other, and they sit there on the date, and the woman is cynical because it's self-protection. She can avoid having to be vulnerable because she's cynical. The man doesn't know any way to get through either, so he becomes cynical. And you've got these two people that are absolutely walled off. So, like, dating in this postmodern world, my God, you know, I've needed years and years of help to understand and like wrap my head around what is going on. The men we work with as well, how can I connect with a woman in my area when, you know, everyone is entrained in this air of cynicism?
Yeah.
And if I'm actually sincere, then I might get derided.
Or hurt really badly. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're sincere and authentic. So we learn very early, don't be authentic. Don't put your heart on your sleeve. Don't express your true feelings. So because you're gonna get burned. Yeah.
Culturally, romantically, artistically, I think we're deep into a cul-de-sac where very few people can see a guiding light to take them in another direction. And I sent you a little video, maybe post this below, about post-irony and meta-irony.
Which so these, is a very post-modern experience. Right, I didn't see it.
Right. So it's going beyond. So the idea of irony and caustic wit and satire is a very postmodern thing. They talk a lot about the boomer satire, like not jokes and this kind of stuff, like actually basic, pretty boring irony.
Memes are all, yeah.
Yeah. And so there is a new breed of memes, like the millennial memes, post-irony, which is you become so ironic at the nature of doing irony that you're now double irony. So you're like, I'm being ironic, but am I being ironic? And so
I'm ironically ironic.
Yeah, it's actually really sweet and beautiful. It's like the humor has become so multi-layered and hyper contextual and strange that it can be quite unnerving and unsettling and jarring, and that there can be a sweetness in that. But what it leaves an individual in is, say, if you go on a date with somebody or you want to, you know, proclaim your work to the world, you're being ironic about being ironic, or even about being ironic. You've got so many different layers of irony. You can't stand on your feet anymore and say, this is who I am, this is how I feel. And this is what I'm seeing a lot of people struggling with, being stuck in ways of showing up and being trapped within a particular sense of humor that keeps them being ironic about being ironic. It's very hard, I think, right now, to put your two feet on the ground and just say something blunt, direct. Yeah,
imagine literature, you know, which is the modern sense of literature, which is all memoir. Imagine the irony of 20-year-olds writing their memoir. And they're taught this. They're taught this. If you take a creative arts class in any university, your assignment is to write your memoir. It's like, huh? That's an ironical thing if you imagine it, you know? So yeah, it's like you can play around with everything now because there's no certainty in the world anymore, apparently. So you can play around with the breaking the fourth wall, you know, like injecting yourself into the art. The artist mm-hmm. now becomes the primary thing as opposed to the artwork, right?
Is that what the fourth wall means?
No, the fourth wall is like comes from theater, I guess, and from it, there's three walls, and the actors are here, and they're talking to each other on the stage. But when they address the audience, they break the fourth wall, and that's ironical. Okay. So in a movie, it's or if you're watching a TV show or a movie, and they turn to the camera and say something to the camera, that's breaking the fourth wall.
Got it. And so in literature, when the narrator actually starts saying, hey, I'm the meta angle, hey, I'm writing a book here. And
I'm going to write Calvino and Umberto Eco, these Italian, you know, writers. And they very much broke that fourth wall, The Name of the Rose and Calvino's works, where he basically said, I'm going to write a novel about this. And here's what I'm going to tell you in the novel. And it's, you know, and that's the, I mean, James Joyce was the one that took that Cervantes and, you know, started the idea of the modern novel and Defoe and all this kind of stuff. And then James Joyce took it to the absolute extreme of deconstruction, I guess you could say. And, you know, as soon as the modern novel was invented, it was deconstructed immediately, you know? So it's that ironical, satirical, the satire has become supreme because and irony is mixed media. So imagine this, we've got the ultimate pastiche. Pastiche is the idea that you take, you know, different things and you stick it into your painting. Here's a piece of newspaper, a collage, right? That's a pastiche. Or you're writing a novel, the modern novel that we have today, and it's got different voices and different perspectives and unreliable narrators, you know, in this modern age, right? The unrelated, should we believe them or not? And when you think of hypertext, which is the internet, That's the ultimate pastiche. So you've got something here, but it's also including everything else that's ever been said about that subject in a hypertext. Wikipedia, yeah. For instance, right? It's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know what age we're in. I have no idea. It's the age of playing around with structure, playing around with narrative, playing around with traditional story themes. Joseph Campbell talked about the hero's journey, and that's been injected in everything. And that's being ripped apart and timelines going backwards and no plots. Well, my book doesn't have a plot, for instance. maybe it's very postmodern. It has no no story, no plot, no. You know, when I was going to publish that book, I ended up publishing it myself. But I went to New York about a year before it was finished. Most people didn't know this, and I beat the streets and I knocked on the doors and I went and talked to literary agents, because New York is the publishing hub of the world, right? I went to publishing companies. I set up all these appointments and I went to them. And they said, okay, we read the first 40 pages of your book. I was just sitting in a boardroom and these publishing executives sitting there, but you have to change it because what is it? They would say, it's not a story. It's not fiction. It's not nonfiction. It's not self-help. It's not a business book. It's not any of these things. Where are we going to put it on the shelf was the thing they kept saying to me. We have no idea it doesn't fit into any genre. We can't put it on the shelf anywhere. So I guess it's a very postmodern book if I think about it now.
I'd love to see on your Wikipedia page, you know, in 50 years when you've gone to the next realm. It says Zamperion's interesting work has been labeled as the epitome of postmodern literature.
Yeah, the end of postmodernism. And then we went back to a real authentic period, you know.
this one man's musings was just this bridge too far.
It's like, that's enough. Tell a story.
Who? All right. Like, so if we bring it back to the perspective of the speck in the ocean, right? Which is really the only perspective we can really know with that much intimacy. How do these different movements and trends and maybe ways of being inspired or maybe ways of being tired by what you see influence the things that you're creating? And like, I'd be curious to hear if structurally, thematically, aesthetically, you're either working with new innovations or feelings that you're bringing in, or if you've seen something really lately that's created a massive impact on you. Oh.
Me personally, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm writing a second book, as most of you know, and I'm dancing around the themes because I don't want to, I can't write anything absolute. I can't write about postmodernism, for instance. I can't say, okay, this is what we're in. Can't talk about the age of men and women, the dynamic age of men and women with any certainty. You know, so I'm kind of struggling with that dance around it and trying to capture something that I can sense is there something I've discovered that I know to pick up in a shovel and share it, you know? No, I don't have that, but I don't have that surety of knowing that I have something concrete that's going to be of value. But I have this strong, strong intimation, a strong intuition, a strong sense that there's something lurking just beyond my sensory perception in the transcendent realm, I guess you could say, that wants to be born, that wants to come through in some way. So like you said, you're tapping into that the concept of the daemon. As you're creating I'm looking for that aspect. I'm not sitting here going, oh, the muse is not touching me. It's not like that. It's like, I want to say something. I want to write something that's real. It's not an answer and it's not a conclusion. It's not something's going to save the world. There's not something's going to be a solution to anything. But I want to write something that has what I want. I know what I want in my book. I can see the cover of it. I know the title of it. I know the content of it. I can see it in my, I can feel it in my hands. I smell it every day. I think about it, but I'm trying to shape something into the narrative of it that captures that that intuition that I have about that there's something else, that there's something to pull into it. I know that's very abstract.
Are you, are you capturing or working to capture the zeitgeist?
Yeah, but I don't want to talk about the zeitgeist. I don't want to talk about modern society and where it went wrong and the age that we're in and maybe this, and because
too many cliches.
Yeah, and it's too many voices talking about that. And I don't want to talk politics. I don't want to talk any of this stuff. I want to talk about the essence of wonder and beauty and try and capture the sense of that again, I think. So that someone who reads it might think, well, now maybe I can strive for that kind of understanding too in my life as a work of art. I can create my life as a work of art. And I don't mean self-help, create a life of excellence. And I'll teach you the 3 points of excellence so that you can, that's self-development, self-help. And it's not that at all, you know, the tradition of literature came down to us, you know.
Is it literature, what you're creating?
Well, I would like to think so. But, you know, it's like saying, like, I'm a philosopher. You know, you know, like, it's others call you a philosopher. You call yourself a philosopher, you're like, what? You know, it's like, yeah, no. So philosophy is something that is created out of someone who's got a very curious mind. And post his, after his ruminations, people say, wow, that's philosophy. That's a philosopher. As opposed to somebody say, I'm going to be a philosopher. I'm starting today. My new job is a philosopher, right? It's like a contrived thing. And I think literature could be the same thing, to say that I'm trying to write literature. Literature is something that is bestowed upon, that's a canon or a label that's bestowed upon something that that people judge to be literature after it was done. You can't say that I'm trying to, you know, understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Well, set out to write literature.
It's something that I wondered about because I haven't done a degree in literature or really kind of know this, but the very definition of literature, it's like, when does something become a work of literature as opposed to a paperback novel?
Yeah, I mean, like, look at...
Page turner or whatever it is, thriller.
Look at T.S. Eliot. He wrote the Ballad of Prufrock. He wrote The Wasteland. And his stated goal of what he was trying to do was to take the English language and the sophistication of the English language and make it accessible to the common person so that the English language would trickle down and infuse the voices and the writing and the common, and guess what we have today? Emojis. The word C is a letter C now. It's like, you know, it's like, it's all, so advertising jingles, this, our language has been completely, the English language has been completely destroyed into these little tiny like emojis, you know, it's essentially, which is the opposite of what he thought would happen with his poetry would bring this language
such
down.
Such a utopianistic idea.
Yeah. And look at language today. It's completely fractured and pastiche, as we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Incredible. It's dumbed down. It's actually, language is dumbed down. If you text something, it's like, it's dumbed down. It's not high art or sophisticated. So whether that's good or bad, I have no idea, but it is what it is. So you try and set out to create a work of art. You know what? I don't think you can create a work of art. I think we talked about this in the very first episode of this show. You can only create something that makes you pause, makes you cry. Something, The Alabaster Girl is a book I wanted to read, and it wasn't out there. There was nothing. 90% of that book, 95% of the book, I never saw anywhere else in the world before or since. Nothing.
Yeah.
Came out of my vomited experience. I wanted to capture something that I saw and experienced. And so it's you can't set out to create art that is in with quotations around that, you know, the artistic experience. You can only create something that you would love, that would make you cry, that would make you pause, make you contemplate. If you have a painting that you've done and you can put it on your wall and look at it and think, you know, like Picasso said, man, it's not what I wanted to do. All artists know this, what they put down on paper, they put down into music, or they put down into the visual arts, the plastic arts, they call it, right? Like painting and stuff like that, is never what they really wanted to capture. It approximated it, and it wasn't quite it, but it never really landed. You know, it's like there's something else. But the beauty of it is that we did that attempt, that they did that, you know, attempt at that. So art is something like literature that is bestowed upon it post creation. Is it art?
Yeah.
Is it cabinet art? It's functional, so we wouldn't call it art. We'd say it's artistic, but you know, it's not, you know, you can put it in a museum, maybe in the Museum of Modern Art, you know, in the furniture section. Yeah.
I was really reflecting this morning on, so I'm 38 next month. And I was feeling, what a wonderful age to start turning my face with more dedication towards art, or whatever that might mean in terms of my own creations. And I say that, I don't say that in a way to dissuade anyone who's not in this particular age bracket. I know you were 40 when you packed up your kind of modern life and threw your hat in the ring to go full-time expressing the daemon. I think when I was traveling in my early 20s, I read Kerouac and a bit of Nabokov and all kinds of people, especially people that were writing about the road.
The road,
and fancied myself as a writer. And I think in the early 20s, it's such a dangerous time to want to write, because all of your pretenses and hopes of being recognized by the adult world as being a success and having made it will filter into your creations and ultimately stultify your attempts of saying something that's true. And I think often, not always, but often, a younger person, or at least a younger version of myself, would have been looking around waiting for the established elites to look at my work and give it the seal of approval.
Right.
So I would have worked my work in such a way that might have got the head nods from the, you know, the literature teacher or the board of the Booker Prize or the Pulitzer Prize or whatever, and try to do things that would be agreeable to the zeitgeist.
That's right. That they would notice, and because it's conforms to what they're looking for.
Exactly. That's right. So that it's going to be very easy to have such a conformist attitude towards art that it just smacks of normality, or such a rebellious attitude to art that it is no longer an expression of who one really is, because the rebellion kind of takes over and pushes the art out of kilter, actually with personal truth and seeing the world really in an empathetic or a compassionate way, which I think is essential. But then on the other hand, I think if you leave it too late, and again, I hope this doesn't sound like a naysaying message if you're in your 60s or whatever, but I was looking at this really beautiful writer's retreat, artist getaway, and it was on this island in Greece. And it was one of these historic islands that has no cars and no motorbikes. And you go there for 7 days with a published author, and you sit in the finest Greek hotel overlooking the bobbing boats in the marina, and you put pen to paper and you talk shop with fellow writers. And I thought, oh, that would be cool. I'd love to do that. Like, what a fun experience. So I looked at the audience, and of course, everyone on this expensive and beautiful writer's retreat was in their mid-60s already. And basically, it's one of these kind of retirement gifts that one can afford for themselves because they've followed the right path all their life. So I looked at everybody who was attending the retreat, right? And they're all sat there with their meals very happily with a glass of wine. It looked like a lovely experience. But everyone is well into their 60s, and it looks like people who have retired well, they're living off a great kind of nest egg, and they can afford to do these beautiful things like go to a Greek island and write. And then I'm thinking, well, the extreme problem with that is that if you wait till you're 60 or 65 before you start following your artistic inclinations, then I believe that a human being has conditioned themselves in such a strong way that they probably won't be able to overcome the rigidity or their conditioning or rigidity in order to get in touch with something that's truly artistic.
Hmm.
This is my sense. So that
in other words, that they turned a corner or something, you know? Is that what you mean?
No, that it's hard to turn the corner. So like if you've put in your decades worth of service to the bank or to the insurance company, or working in that office on that particular kind of technology, and all of a sudden you want to go to Greece and be an artist, and you're age 60, you've spent 30 or 40 years of your life learning computer code, or learning tax systems, or learning invoicing, or learning all kinds of other kind of rigid, rational world, you know, functional things, that when at the age of 65 you want to tap into the daemon and cross paradigms together and create something that's on the edge and bleed the heart out on the sleeve, it's going to be extremely difficult to overcome that conditioning. So this is why I'm becoming more and more bullish about follow your passions and do your vision quest young.
Yeah, me too.
If you have the inclination. So I've been watching, I like this guy, Mr. Money Mustache, right? Financial independence, retire early. And this is a big concept. Financial independence, retire early. What's not to like, right? So they have this whole way that you work really hard for 10 or 15 years. You put 50, 70% of your income away, and then you can reach the age of 35 or 40, have enough of a nest egg behind you that you can live the rest of your life in retirement.
Right, frugally. So
frugality is the name of the game before retirement. And usually when you retire, you realize, actually, I don't need that much to be happy. I'm happy already. Right. So I retire fairly frugally. What makes my guts cruel about, because I've really entertained this way of living, right? What makes my guts squirm with this is that in order, if you have any kind of artistic or passionate or romantic inclination, in order to achieve your goal, you have to sacrifice yourself to the cubicle life for 10 years.
Yeah.
And as you know, with the men that we work with, if you spend your life between the age of 21 and 35 in the cubicle, making money, filling out the spreadsheet, invoicing the customers, watching the red and green charts going up and down on the page, and then you want to be 35 years old and you want to follow the daemon, you want to sail in the winds, you want to be able to enjoy life to a level that is infectious, to have a beautiful woman want to come on your ride with you rather than feel slightly bored and stilted in your company. If you want to let all that conditioning go and then become a lover or an artist, it's really hard work because you've conditioned yourself into a certain rigidity. So.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thought.
Go young and don't condition because of the carrot of money. Retirement, and obviously it's much easier said than done, right? To think in myself, if I want to go and pursue a real passion for literature, and then like, what about my coaching business, which I fought tooth and nail for to start to make stable and so on, and have these clients, if I really like, what about that? If I turn my face more about that, it's there's a fear of like, oh, I've got to a certain level here. How could I?
In other words,
towards this chaotic direction.
To devote your life to the possibility of starving artist mode your whole life. I know a guy right now who's in Norway who's painting and dedicated and say, I'm just going to, if I starve, I starve. I'm going to continue just doing this sort of thing, right? And the extreme of that would be Charles Bukowski, who just lived in the streets and flop houses and did his writing. And, you know, and then the opposite of that, I think it was T.S. Eliot again. I mentioned him earlier, who wrote this sublime poetry of the age that captured the age. Was it T.S. Eliot or Wordsworth? No, it was T.S. Eliot, I think, who got a job as a banker. He was an artist. And he had, and he was like, he got tired of the uncertainty of it. He got a job as a banker and he thrived. He loved being a banker. He was working in the bank at the same time. He was doing all this, you know, this artistic stuff. So, but that's what I really like what you're saying is if we're waiting for that nest egg to accumulate or waiting for these things to be taken care of and this debt consolidated, et cetera, get all that behind us. Then we can turn our face to the artistic realm. That's the failing. And I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
That's why when you talk about a writing retreat in Greece, it's for people who want to kickstart their writing by sitting and communing with other writers, right?
Yes.
In other words, they're starting now and they're all in, you know, in their September years. Yeah. And like you said, they're all older and now they're going to start their writing career because I'm retired now. And I was a banker and I did all that. And that's an interesting concept. I completely agree that if you have any desire for beauty or artistic energy or want to create a life of art, get out of society, get out of the wide and beaten path, go down the narrow path, the road not taken. Absolutely 100% agree with that. Scare yourself, go into some different countries, go into different cultures, learn what you're made of. Learn to figure out how to stand on your two feet, you know? I completely agree with that. Interesting thought that the people who have finished their careers are now wanting to turn into this artistic thing that they've been desiring since they were little kids.
Yeah.
It's always been there.
And it might be too late to actually access that daemon, true creative spark of the guts, the gizzards, the soul.
Well, you know, if you look at anything that was done creatively in the history of the world, from Mozart to whatever, it was done in their early years. Now, you look at someone like Renoir or Matisse, and they were painting and creating stuff. Matisse was crippled, and he's old, and he's crippled, because he can't paint anymore, he started doing cutouts with scissors, and he made these incredible things that are in artwork museums around the world, his cutouts, and Picasso's looking at it going, wait a minute, and Picasso's old now too. He's like, should I copy that? Because I stole everything else that he did. So it's like, you know, and there were some writers that were writing really late in life, 90 years old. Excuse me, not who they were, but I know of some, and creating artistic works at that age, but very few. You know, Freud, Jung, all these people that they had this flowering of ideas and their artistic output. Einstein, everything was in their 20s and you know, the early years is when they created this. That's when the spark is the most alive and you have less cynicism, right? We talked about. Yeah. That's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought of that, what you're saying. But it's true. Go and find it now. The poem by Kipling that I always quote, you know, is like, it's something there is calling you behind the ranges, behind the hills. Something there beyond civilization is calling you now. Go and find it. Go and, you know, there's a poem by Kipling, and I can't remember exactly the name of it, but incredible. It's interesting that you're tapping into this part of you, this spark of creativity that in your life, Jordan, and you've dedicated your life to it. You've dedicated your, I mean, it's behind you in the back of the wall there, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the crazy, I'm going to go off and do what calls me for sure. And this is just another threshold, just another chapter in the book.
Yeah. We had, you know, like I said, the axial age in 800 BC, 300 BC, we had the Middle Ages and what came out of that, the Renaissance, the Baroque period in the 1600s, Enlightenment in the 1700s, and then Enlightenment and materialism and humanism and naturalism arose, and we solve everything with mathematics and solve everything with scientific inquiry, and everything, and the universe has the logic and order to it. And the romanticism of Blake and Shelley and Byron and Wordsworth and you know, Emerson and these guys were like, wait a minute, no, let's rebel against this mechanistic view of the universe. And this put flowery notes back into it. And this return to the classics. Everybody, in it, if you were born, 200 years ago, you would have done the Grand Tour. And the Grand Tour was like the European would go to Italy for sure, go to Florence and go to Rome and stuff like that, and look at the classics and try and bring the classicism, you know, the elements of the Roman and Greek classics that were rediscovered basically in that age in the Enlightenment, and re-put it back into the art of England and put it back into the art of Western society. It's, you know, that's the Romantics. They went on the Grand Tour. Every young man had to do that, all the way down to Greece and stuff like that. And then realism and naturalism, you know, which is, you know, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky talk about what's real, and it's dirty. Life is dirty. Dickens wrote about it. Like it's London is dirty. It's disgustingly dirty, and nothing beautiful, no utopia that we're talking about, right? And then you shift from that to modernism and avant-garde and Art Nouveau and then Joyce and D.H. Lawrence, Conrad were writing these things, Yeats writing poetry, and all the way up to, you know, the World War II with Camus. Camus wrote his book in 1942, I think, The Stranger. I can't remember. And then now, since then, 1950 now is mass market, postmodern, anything goes, there's nothing certain. Beckett, you know, the cynicism of Samuel Beckett, mm-hmm. the deconstruction of every modern art, the artist is prime. Deconstruction, as you said, so, and inject the artist into it, breaking that the fourth wall we talked about, pastiche, hypertext, and then the age that's coming. What are we starting? Because for sure something's happening. You can feel it, mm-hmm. because of this coronavirus that's blanketing the earth, and the aggression in politics in the United States, for instance, the complete schism that's happening in the States, where like something is ending. And I don't know if it is, I said it in an earlier podcast, is it the end of in the Enlightenment? But something's changing, and people are realizing that we have all the trappings of fulfillment, but nobody's fulfilled. So something has to be born. Something has some prophet in the wilderness is going to arise, or something's going to happen, and people are going to turn back to something that was classic. For instance, massive emigration or turning back towards religion, organized religion. I don't know, but something's going to happen. Something shifts in the air.
It's amazing how profound and widespread, I think, everyday participation with spirituality, even in self-help guises. Like my mom back home teaches Reiki and meditation now. That was a very late in life find for her. So it's like in the most kind of traditional little town, in the midst of the Western world, there's just mushrooms of people that are asking more and more of these questions. I wanted to say, first of all, it's so pleasurable just to listen to you go through history and drop these different names and how they were living and what they were finding, what they were thinking, like just to be on a kind of historical, artistic, literary journey and just hear the tales of all these different people that lived and contributed to the lineage of that is so rich. Yeah. Like that, there's so much richness. Like I could listen for hours, like who was this guy and who was that and why did he write this novel and what, like philosophically, what was that on the back of and how did he play with structure to transmit a different message in a whole new way that affected people at that particular time who are living in a particular zeitgeist. Like that just...
Yeah, blows my mind too, Jordan. It's incredible to me. That's why I am very optimistic for our future. And I've been optimistic from the first day. I'm not cynical at all. I don't have a sense of cynicism in my body at all. And I've seen some real bad things in my life, you know? But I'm optimistic because if you look at... We're just this blip and on this timeline of civilization, and we're living in a super interesting time. My optimism is about the potentiality of what can be created, like the artistic age that can be abound out of this. What we talked about in an earlier podcast is the idea of frissonism, the idea of frisson, you know, the French word that means goosebumps. basically, and nobody has, science hasn't captured that. Nobody's talked about it. Nobody's written about it. But it's the age of Friesenism, where we feel something. And you talked about your mom talking about Reiki and stuff like that. All these cultures have been pulled into what we would call Western civilization. We talk about universal truths of the West from the Greeks and Romans and, you know, the British Empire and stuff like that. We have these universal truths of, you know, what's real. And which is, you know, what we're realizing today, that's really a kind of like Western dominated thinking, of course, right? But now the Orient and Asiatic cultures are being brought into, so that's true globalization. You know, we have these nations, the nation states arose, but globalization is pulling in all these different influences. So now somebody can have a hint of Buddhism in his Catholicism. He's got Stoicism, and he brings all this into his thinking. And your mother brings Reiki into, you know, alternative medicine practices and acupuncture that are from the East, right? You bring it all, because it's all blending globalization. And everybody wants globalization. This modern liberal culture wants globalization, but then they complain about cultural appropriation. That's what it is. It's cultural appropriation. It's a blending of cultures and erasing of borders so that, you know, Germany is not Germany, England's not England. It's a melting pot. Canada, where I'm from, is famously called the melting pot, because Every culture is represented. In the neighborhoods in Vancouver, you have Sikh neighbors, you have Chinese neighbors, and they're Canadian, but they hold their culture near and dear to their heart. Your Sikh neighbor might invite you in for the traditional food, and they keep their traditions, but they're also fundamentally, ultimately Canadian. So they've really blended in, you know. And I don't know what I'm talking about, but it's interesting times. Super interesting times.
Yeah, the nuts thing about it is that obviously we can't give ourselves a name or a descriptor or really talk about the times until they're over.
Yeah.
So whatever phase we're in now, it's going to take 30 or 40 years until we're able to look at this particular movement and the things that were happening now with a name, postmodernism, or, you know, whatever it ends up being called, this new emergent thing. We'll be able to look at these black box podcast recordings of having feeling where we're at, seeing what's going on in the world, having no idea how to describe our own motivations and our own influences and inclinations and what it was all about. And some clever philosopher will psychoanalyze us basically and basically say, oh, those people in the early 2020s, new sincerity, like the antidote to snark and cynicism is new sincerity. Like these people came through and they wanted to speak about soul and the transcendent again, bring that through in literature. People are talking about that.
Maybe 100 years now, they'll talk about Jordanism, that age of Jordanism. It's like the guys that tried to write a manifesto for Stuckism.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
In the 80s, I think they did that. There's these guys said, we manifest a new age of art called Stuckism because we're stuck. So we're going to create this thing. And they create a manifesto and consciously create the next age. If we're going to step forward and create that age. But it's like literature. It's like high art. It's not proclaimed that until after. So the ism comes after, when we look back in hindsight and go, wait a minute, that era, like consumerism, we can look back in the 80s and 90s and think, wow, that was heavily consumerism. And we can call it consumerism now. When we're in it, we didn't know. We're buying, you know, our 80s toys and you know, an optimistic lifestyle back in the 80s, right?
This is beautifully reflected in the Woody Allen film, Midnight in Paris, where he goes back to the 1920s, a modern American writer, and he's just like, this is heaven to me. Like, look at all these people, Hemingway and Gertrude Stein, everyone is sat around and they're partying. And he thinks it's like, that was the moment when it was all happening. If we only could go back to the 1920s. Yeah. And when you listen to everybody there, they're cynical as hell. They've got nowhere to be. They don't want to be in America and the Prohibition. Paris is dirty and full of wretches. And
they hate their life.
Yeah.
And the girl he met back there, remember the French girl he met, at the end of the movie, they got transported. I don't want to spoil the movie, but they got transported back to an earlier time, the Belle Époque. Yes. And she's like,
she thought, this is where it's happening.
This is romantic. I wish I was born in this era. And she was born in the 20s, or she's come of age in the 20s in Paris, which we romanticize and think, man, can we, if we were hanging around with Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Picasso and Gertrude Stein and we would be so enthralled and so inspired, and we'd be part. No, they hated their lives. They were competing with each other. They picked at each other. You know, they couldn't stand their own work. They're suspicious of other work. They picked. It's incredible. It's all a cynical age, you know.
Yeah.
And wishing for a better past, the good old days.
If you're a historian watching this from the 2050s, and you want to get the inside scoop on what it was like to linger and lurk around the night spots of Bucharest back in the teens. Yeah. I'll sit there with a cigar and whiskey on your documentary and tell some tall tales.
Because it's culture.
in a rocking chair. Yeah.
That's well, cool. Zan wasn't really like how they projected him in the books.
He did write the ultimate postmodern, the capstone of the postmodern age, though. He wrote the book that everybody said, this is ridiculous. Let's get back to some normalcy now.
And thereby saved culture with its very writing.
With my absurdism. That's great. That's funny, man.
Wow. Here's a little concept I wanted to add to the table. Up here on my wall, I've got a few different archetypes. So within all the people that we work with, there's some archetypes that show up again and again and again. And I thought about the people that we work with because... I wanted to get, what I mean by archetype is not like werewolf and vampire and so on, which we talk about sometimes with the archetype stuff, but it's like, what's the fundamental life circumstance that this man is in? And what are his motivations and his limiting factors and his yearnings and so on? And what's ultimately going to drive this character forward? And there's millions of all of these archetypes. But one of them I've got is the words need refining. The silent aesthetic amidst the culture wars.
That's an archetype?
Yeah.
So he's an aesthete?
Yes.
Or he or her?
Aesthete. Yeah. So
the silent
to flesh
aesthete.
That out a little bit more, you know, we've talked quite a lot about the culture wars and this way of activism or violent activism or destroy the opponent kind of activism.
Yeah.
Rather than let's stand for the goodness and beautify what is our heart's concern form of that
discourse. Yeah.
So we're in the middle of warring factions, right? That doesn't need much more explanation. Just turn on the media any day of the week. But then those are the ones making all the noise. And so there is a silent, I believe, majority that are sat there in their university faculties, in their office cubicles, in front of their kind of big computer home work office space. And they're watching these culture wars go by, saying a few things, ending up in some snark, backing off, not wanting to really do much in that whole realm because whatever perspective you put out there into the world, it's kind of like sticking your arm out the window in a moving train. It might just get ripped off by some oncoming ire. And I think... This is who we're talking to a lot in our podcast and in the Amorati. Men who would like actually to stand up for something beautiful and to stick their sword in the ground and say, this is something I love, this is something I defend, this is something of inherent beauty and meaning that I want to protect and somehow live my life in accordance with. And so I believe in the goodness and the beauty of this. And here is my expression of that. Here is my, I don't know, YouTube video or my book or my article or my something. And I think what's missing for this archetype is the man who's watching this feeling really excited and really fired up, like, yeah, I want to be part of a brand new movement that restores and restates beauty into the cultural milieu. And I really don't know how to do it because not only might I get cancelled or derided by the snarky culture out there, but the second part of this is it's so easy to postmodernism is so freaking easy. Let's just take a few lofty concepts from the philosophy lab
take them out into the world and look at the heroes of literature and demolish them one by one for their character faults that we all have, it's so much harder to sit down and say, okay, rather than critique or criticize others, I'm actually going to create something I truly believe in. Like, I'm Stephen King, and I'm going to write my first book, and I'm going to try and put it out there because I think I've got a talent. But then, of course, you know, you end up contorted into this pit of self-hatred and throw your manuscript on the fire. And so this artistic challenge, like, I think this podcast episode has all been about the celebration of the daemon and the different people who had access to, let's fucking do something at our time in history. Let's rewrite what's happening now, because there's something unsatisfactory about the present moment. I want to bring in the next moment. This whole lineage of people that have been doing that, the artistic striving for generations. And it's so hard actually just to say, this is my expression. I believe in this. I want to put it out there into the world and offer this up as a gift to culture. It's really rare. I think there's very little support of it. We're lacking training in participatory culture in the first place. So we hit, you know, our 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, never learned how to play an instrument, never learned how to sing, never learned how to really craft a letter, like to write a love letter. We never learned how to really craft a letter that would touch somebody, because just the way our modern world has gone. And so with this archetype, the silent aesthetic, he sits there in the midst of all this schmaggin, smart, snarky, awful cultural warring, fighting that's going on. And it's like, how can he find himself self-expressed and find meaning in his life? Because one finds meaning by creating beauty. You know, one finds meaning by finding and seeking and having an encounter with beauty. One finds, I think, even more meaning through creating and working with beauty.
Yeah. So what's the path of that, the silent aesthete because there is no message for him. You can't look at media. You can't look at universities. There's no message for that soul. There's nothing that. So, I mean, if you look at what we're trying to do with this Ars Amorata body of work, is it's an antidote to snark. It's an antidote to this postmodern cynicism. I think so, right?
And I think that both the modern and the postmodern world is so tremendously disembodied that I think if you go to most faculties to learn any kind of art or self-expression that you might want to, you're going to get such a mental critique of it.
You're
going to get all the fanciest guns, but I think ultimately, anyone that ever created something that's truly notable had to have a connection, first of all, with the body. Because if you're writing from a place that is disconnected from sensation, emotion, empathy, true sensitivity, it's not going to cut it. And also, whatever the sublime means to you, there has to be a connection to that as well. Otherwise, like, if you write a book that you never have frisson during its creation, then how can you ever hope to transmit anything of true consolation to the reader? You're only going to transmit urinals, you know, pages and pages of philosophical leaps and jokes and abstractions from
essays.
The last guy that abstracted before you. Yeah,
exactly. It's just essays, and there's a million essays out there. We're awash in essays and opinions, and you're just adding to the noise. I completely agree. If it doesn't touch you, if it isn't something that give you those goosebumps and make you pause your life and think, you know, what am I made of, and what is my purpose in this universe? You know, maybe there is no purpose, but at least you're contemplating that, you know? So yeah, I completely 100% agree with you. If it doesn't touch you, if you're not creating a life and an artwork out of that life, whatever that artwork is to you, and it doesn't have that coherence of frisson, that doesn't have that crying moment for you, that moment of contemplation. So you look at what you've created and have this moment of of contemplation about it and how it affects you. And if you don't have that, then you're just then you're just the part of the masses of people who just go through life as consumers. That, you know, maybe they're born and they go to the grave and they consume as much as they can until they get there. And no judgment on that, because maybe some people are just uncritically thinking. They don't have critical thinking. They don't contemplate, and they're pleasantly happy, you know, with the simplicity of that. So it's no critique, but nobody listening to this point, however long we've been talking, is one of those unwashed, you know, masses, part of the unwashed masses at all.
Yeah, it's got to have some curiosity and stamina for this conversation.
To stick with this long.
I think, what am I saying with this? I mean, this is not fleshed out, but there are silent aesthetes among us more than I think have reared their heads. And I think at least I want to create a conversation and a forum and some kind of breadcrumb trail that they can follow to become, to bring somehow their own light, their own fully embodied soul force into the world through the artistic things that they create.
Through even tried to foster
the businesses
that
they create.
We're tried to foster that with our Amirati group of men. You know, we've had this membership for over a decade, and it's the men that we want to stand shoulder to shoulder with and say, that's my brother. And when I travel in the world, I visit him, or, you know, we sit and we break bread with these guys because they have an artistic bent. They want to understand a better way of the conversation, the dynamic of men and women, of living their life as a creative work of art. They want to make a jewel out of the best they can. It's going to be an imperfect jewel. And they're going to make mistakes, and they're going to blow it along the way. But when they look back, they can look back with this kind of kind smile to themselves in the mirror that says, at least I tried it. At least I didn't settle, and I tried to fight for this, you know? So that's what we try and do with the Amirati group of guys and the women that are part of that experience too. And there's volumes. So, yeah. That's why you're creating, you know, we have these courses, essentials and stuff yet for the Ars Amirata philosophy. And you're constantly, and both of us, and, you know, and Serene and our entire team is constantly reevaluating, reinventing, rewriting, readjusting to make it more and more capture the zeitgeist and capture the true tone of what we've been trying to say for two decades, you know. It's true. Anyway, exciting times.
Any final maybe word of advice or wisdom or encouragement? Putting yourself in the seat, in the ears and the eyes of somebody who's just been through this episode, who might be like, yeah, I love beauty. I wish I had more of a connection to the arts. I wish I understood this world more. I wish I could create something that's an expression of my soul, who I am on the inside. And yeah, I have a busy life with plenty of pressures, work commitments, study. I'm afraid of not having money to live a nice life. I'm afraid of not being able to travel. I'm confined because of family, children, and whatever, because of so many different circumstances. To the person listening to this, what's something practical they can do? Here's a better question. Since you and I have both mercilessly slaughtered ties to the safe world in order to live a life according to the daemon, like whatever is my full-blooded inspiration, I'm going to follow that and create in accordance to that. What can someone do?
Well, like you said, circumstances are constraint. If you murdered somebody in your 20s, you might be in jail for the next 20 years. There's nothing you can do about that circumstance. You can't say, oh, I want to go live in open up an umbrella drink shop in Bali. You can't do that because your circumstances have constrained you. You might have three kids, like you said. Yeah. You might have a debilitating illness, you know, a physicality that constrains. And so you can't be an astronaut. you know, like this power of positive thinking and the idea of the secret, you know, the secret is, as you just, if you, the universe will give you what you imagine. We have constraints around that, which is called circumstantial constraints. But within that, you can choose to live a life of beauty and contemplation. You can choose, I've got three children and I want to maximize the experience of them so that they learn about culture that I was handed down, for instance, right? They can learn about things as opposed to sitting on their phones I gave them when they're 7 years old. They all got their own phones and their own Facebook account and Twitter account. Instead of that, you can give them the wholesomeness of being present with them, to play in the dirt with them, to teach them how to do things with their hands, to teach them art, you know, in real space, which we don't, because we're caught up in our own phones. So if you have this artistic bent, then, and you have circumstances around it, if you don't have circumstances, if you have nothing holding you back but a job, leave, renounce this old you, this was following the safe path, the way of the, you know, the well-beaten trodden path, renounce it and go on the path, you know, less taken. Absolutely. To within the limits of your constraints of your circumstances. Absolutely. You have to do that. And if you're completely constrained, like you're in prison, for instance, and you have no choice but the cell, that's your only choice. Then within the walls of that cell, sit in the contemplation of the existence of your life on this time in the universe. And contemplate the universe, contemplate, learn about physics, learn about these modern concepts that are just wondrous, wondrous concepts that are just fascinating. Look at the creation of the periodic table of the elements. Look how that came together out of a creative dream state. You know, it was like, it was intuited and nobody put it together. And Mendeleev, I think it was, had this, I can't remember. He had this crazy dream and it's like, wait. And he wrote it all down. And it's like, how did I come up with this? Where did that come from? And it was immediately apparent that it was right. And the scientific world looked at it, the chemical world looked and goes, wow, that's right. How come we didn't think of that? I was on the edge of thinking that, but I didn't. So you could do that. Newton, you know, Newton had his Annus Mirabilis, his year of miracles, where he created calculus because he was stuck in a coronavirus-like. He fled London into the back country of England because of the plague. So he ran away from coronavirus, and for a year he quarantined himself, and he came up with calculus. He came up with the you know, the laws of momentum and planetary motions and the idea of gravity came up thinking, sitting by himself, scratching his ass, thinking. The apple falling on his head, you know, apocryphally. That's in that year of quarantine that he created that. So circumstances do not constrain us, that sense of wonder and curiosity and creative energy. That's my final thought.
Beautiful. I think that's a wrap.
Okay. Excellent. Another episode in the bag?
In the can.
And what do you say to the people who are listening?
Cue official end of podcast spiel. If you've been inspired or had some insight or inspiration from the conversation, drop your comment below. I was also going to add, when you were saying the last little bit, if there was a book or a movie or an artist that you always intuited that you should read, but you never did because, you know, it's kind of a waste of time. It's not useful to spend time reading literature or something like that. Then dig out that book and have an experience with it and let us know what you find in the comments below. And probably there's some old book that you picked up or you saw one time and thought, hey, I heard some people talk about that.
Like, yeah, and share it in the comments.
I should read that and let us know what it was. And let us know what experience you had when you were reading it and how it changed you afterwards to have the experience with the book.
And if you know somebody that might like this conversation, then share, for sure, subscribe to our channel because we're going to be putting out this and other content and share it with others. Like if you want somebody to hear this kind of what we're blathering on about, then share it with others too so we can get the word out about what we're trying to fight for and what we're trying to create, because you're part of that sharing of that momentum and that sharing of this it's a new cultural age that we're embarking upon, and you can be part of that. Number one, by like Jordan said, to leave behind the surly bonds of earth and go live it in a life of artistic beauty, like you talked about, Jordan. Not afraid of money, not afraid of all these things, and share it with others. It's incumbent upon you to take what you've learned to share it with others. That's incredible. That's how you learn. That's how you inhabit it in your body, the concepts. So very cool. We'd like to see you in the future.
Cool. So click, like, subscribe, all that kind of stuff that you usually find around a YouTube video. And if you want to stay in touch with us, you can find the newsletter on our website and the wait list also for our membership.
Join the membership, the Amorati. Amorati.net, Amorati.net. Join the membership. We have a class 2-3 times a year, and it's a 90-day course, and you get in and you become part of this group that's forever in this conversation. It's great. Got a great group of people.
Right on. Oh man, hey. I feel like a glass of wine. If ever I felt like a glass of wine, tonight.
There you go, Jordan. Excellent.